Veteran Podcast. Thank you for your service.
Welcome back, everybody, to Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. We're switching it up a little bit this week, and we're going back to the top of the show for our announcements and all that stuff, and there's a reason for it. I don't want to take anything away from an amazing interview that we have today with Jim Lorraine. He's the president and CEO of America's Warrior Partnership. Awesome interview. Great time talking to this guy. We talk about community. We talk about preventing veteran suicide and how we can do that at the lowest possible level and actually getting ahead of it and looking for those upstream markers that let us know that somebody needs help. And again, you're going to love this interview. So I'm going to be quick at the top of the show. I just want to get out some information to you guys. We talked last week about raising money for Hunter 7 to provide cancer screening for veterans. And I said that, I was talking about how I went for my colonoscopy and they found some precancerous cells and they were able to take care of it. And I was so blessed that that happened and it was early detection and how important early detection is when we talk about cancer, especially for veterans. And I wanted to pass that blessing along to other people. So what we're doing is we're going to be raising money for Hunter 7 to buy these screening kits. They're made by a company. I'll probably mispronounce the name. It's called Gallery. And it's a 50 cancer screening test or a multi-cancer screening test. You basically just take a blood draw and it looks for the markers. It can see if there's cancer present. And where it's coming from, or at least a cancer signal, all right? There's still more testing that you need to do and all of that, and this doesn't replace your normal screening like colonoscopies and PSAs and mammograms and all that stuff. So this isn't to replace it, but this provides early detection. And now, why do we care about that? Well, so my case, okay, if I didn't go for that early colonoscopy. I mean, I'm not scheduled to probably go for a colonoscopy for another 3-4 years, probably 5 by the time I actually would have gone. You don't know what those precancerous cells would have been like. I could have been having a completely different conversation with my doctor. Veterans aren't great at taking care of ourselves. Let's be honest. Okay. We don't go to the doctor very often. We've been told since we were in the military, don't worry about it. Take a knee, drink some water. Here's an ibuprofen. Shut the hell up. Get back in line. So it's kind of ingrained in us to not complain and not take care of ourselves very well, not go to our GP once a year for our physical and do blood draws and all that kind of stuff. I've been guilty of it in the past. And also, we have a lot of veterans out there that can't afford these more advanced tests. Maybe they only have minimal health care that doesn't cover it. Maybe they're not working right now and they don't have health care. There's a lot of different things. Hunter 7 wants to kind of bridge that and get past all that. And if we see somebody that's at risk that we know needs this test, we want to be able to provide it for them. And like I said, through Hunter 7, who's getting these kits and finding the people that need them and making sure that they get this early detection and this early screening. So what we've done is we've set up a fundraiser for Hunter 7. All the money will go directly to them, okay? It's to buy these multi-cancer early detection kits, okay? And basically what they do is, like I said, you do a blood draw. This now allows the doctor to see if you have any of these signals, these cancer signals, and where they're coming from. So it might say, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to try to explain it, but I guess what happens is through the blood draw, they can tell, hey, there's a cancer signal coming from the prostate. All right, let's go. And then they'll do an exam and they go further. But now it starts the ball rolling on that early detection and early treatment, which greatly increases your chance of one, survivability, and also quality of life, because the vast majority of cancers show no symptoms until later stages. And then the treatment options are much more limited. All right. Many cancers are found way too late and the outcome's already going to be deadly. So we want to get way ahead of that and way upstream of that. Okay. About 70% of cancer deaths are caused by cancers not commonly screened for. All right. So you're going for your colonoscopy, you're going for your PSA, you're going for your mammogram, you're going for a pap smear, but it's not those cancers that are probably going to kill you. You're not screening generally for lung cancer, brain cancers, bone cancers, these types of things. We're not, it's not until some type of a symptom comes up that you go to the doctor and, hey, doctor, something, I'm having trouble breathing, or I'm getting constant headaches, or whatever the case may be, that we actually talk about it. So proactively screening for these things, like I said, it takes the fight to cancer. And as someone who has had cancer in my family that has run rampant and taken many lives from my family, if there's a way that I can help with this, I want to. So from the Bulletproof Veteran community, we are going to do this, okay? So what's going on? We're going to be putting a link out. We're going to be using Fund the First. Now, this is an organization that's really cool. They only do fundraisers for first responders, military, those types of organizations and people. They do a lot of personal fundraising for, if a police officer was lost in the line of duty, they'll raise money for the families and stuff like that. But it's not like a GoFundMe or anything like that. It's the same style, but it focuses specifically on military first responders. So I wanted to use them. I think they're actually out of New York. So we're going to use them. It's all set up. I'm going to be putting out the link. I'm going to do a short video that I'll probably post on Instagram and stuff like that. It'll also be on the website for the fundraiser. Initially, I'm just trying to raise money for three kits. It's about $2,700. The kits range from $600 to $900 a piece. We can raise $2,700, give it to Hunter 7. That's three kits that they can buy for, a veteran that they have identified as somebody that should be screened. And they have their whole process. I'm not going to get involved in all that. They're very good at what they do. I let the professionals be professionals. But we can provide money and we can help them because these kits are not cheap. Hunter 7 needs the money to do this. They're not free. Nobody's just giving these things out. So we want to be able to help in that. So what we're going to do is we're just going to ask you whatever you can give, $10, $5, $50, $100, whatever you can do, you're going to go to the website and you're just going to donate. The check goes directly to Hunter 7. So it's great. I don't have to get involved in the money. I don't like being involved in money. They get it. They know what it's for and they know what it's from. I've already reached out to Hunter 7 to let them know that I was going to do this. And, they were very thankful. And to anybody out there that does donate, thank you already. Like I said, all the information will be there and it's going to be really simple. It's secure. You don't have to worry about any scams or anything like that. This is the best way to do it. Fund the First is awesome at what they do. They've been recognized in many publications as being the best crowdsourcing for first responders and military. So, thank you for what they do. And that's why we went with them to use them. I felt really secure in that. I thought it was putting a good name out there to run the fundraiser. Please, if you can't, don't worry about it. Like, I get it. Times are tough. Money's tough. Another reason why I wanted to do this because, people don't have expendable cash to do 50 cancer screening kits right now. If you can give, give. And we thank you so much. If you can't give, listen, if you want to help out in another way, share it. Share it on your Instagram, Facebooks, Twitters, TikToks, whatever. Help me just raise as much money as possible because $2,700 was our goal. That gets us three kits. Listen, if we shatter that and go past, that's just more kits. All the money just keeps going. So we just want to do the best that we can, get as many kits as we possibly can, get as many veterans screened as we possibly can, and help Hunter 7 out in their mission. So again, the link will be in this episode. I'll also be putting it in my bio on Instagram and Twitter and all of that. You'll be able to just click it and go. I'll be posting videos and sharing, and we'll be talking about the cancer kits. I'll post some information about them. We'll put it on the website. If you have any questions, you can always email at bulletproofveteran@gmail.com. And I'll get back to you and any information that I can provide. If you have questions or you want to know how can you get involved in another way or whatever, just email me and I'll get back to you. Again, thank you, Fund the First, for allowing us to use your platform for this. It's awesome. And thank you to everybody out there that potentially will be donating and helping us get to our goal of the three kits for Hunter 7 for this cancer screening. All right. Think that's it. All right. Like I said, I want to get into Jim's interview because I really think you're going to love it. But I wanted this to be at the top of the show because I want to get as many people involved as possible. I know Jim would completely understand me breaking in and doing it this way. He's a good guy, and I know he would have no problem with it. So I think that's it. I think that's all we got to say for right now. All right. You know, the normal stuff, follow Twitter, Instagram. That's all secondary right now. Let's get out. Let's raise some money for Hunter 7. That's the important thing. All right. But without further ado, let's get to this week's interview. All right, everybody, welcome back to Bulletproof Veteran Podcast. It's great to be with you again this week as we kind of dive into a topic that is hard to talk about, but at the same time, needs to be talked about. And I think we talk about it quite often on this show, and veteran suicide always pops up when we're talking about these different organizations that are trying to help. But one thing that we talk a lot about is community and how important community is for the overall well-being of veterans when they come home. And not just veterans, but their families, the caregivers, for disabled veterans and for veterans that are dealing with issues, you know, that spouse or that mother or father or that husband or that child that might be taking care of the veteran, we don't want to forget about them. So we're going to kind of dive into all of that. And again, it's kind of wrapped up in the suicide prevention, but it goes much deeper than that when we start talking about how important the community is in making that happen, when we talk about these different VSOs that are out there and how we can make them better by really involving the community, your neighbors, your schools, all these different entities that kind of play in and can really provide for these VSOs to do their jobs. So today on the show, we're going to be talking to Jim Lorraine. He is the president and CEO of America's Warrior Partnership. You might see them online. We've seen them on a great website and also a very good Instagram presence of a lot of stuff that they're doing. So, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, Jason, thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's excellent to talk to you. Like we usually do on the show, and I say this every week, I like to hear a little bit about the person behind the organization before we kind of dive in. So I'd love to hear a little bit about you. You are a fellow Air Force veteran like myself, so that always makes me happy to have my Air Force brothers and sisters on the show. So please, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. So my background is that I joined the Air Force out of Syracuse University back in 1985. Served 22 years as a flight nurse. So that took me... took me all over the world, especially when I was stationed in Germany, flew Europe, Middle East, Africa, participated in Desert Shield Storm. Then I came back from my European tour, and I was stationed down at Pope Air Force Base and ended up in this little place called Somalia. Did a bunch of time in Mogadishu. When I came back, we did some other work. Anyways, my career was in air medical evacuation. Because of my ties in Somalia, I went over to Special Operations Command. And at the end of my career, I retired as the Deputy Command Surgeon at United States Special Operations Command. But that's when the journey sort of started, because at the time, the commander of SOCOM, General Brown, said, hey, I want to make sure that we're taking care of all the wounded, ill, or injured that were in Special Operations. So the Navy SEALs, the Green Berets, the Rangers, the Air Commandos, the Marine Raiders. We wanted to make sure that everyone who had been wounded or ill or injured, we knew who they were, number one, and then we would advocate for them for the rest of their life. And the goal of that was to pay back the fact that these folks volunteered four or five times. I tell you that in detail because it's really the basis for what we do now at America's Warrior Partnership, which was when I was at Special Operations Command, we went out and found everybody who had been wounded or injured. We understood where they were in their life and where they wanted to go. We connected them to government, non-government resources, and then we followed them and we stayed tight to them. They knew that somebody always had their six and that there was nothing they were going to face alone. And that we could get through probably some of the most complex bureaucracies to make sure broad service. So that when my wife, who was also active duty Air Force, when she retired, I came home. I was working for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I came home one night back down to Tampa, and there was a sign that was a for sale sign in front of my house. I said, so are we doing something? She said, I'm moving to Aiken, South Carolina. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm moving. And so I moved to Augusta, Georgia, Aiken, South Carolina, and filled a gap for about 90 days for a little nonprofit that was in the local area, and it's turned into 11 years. And we've grown from a program called Augusta Warrior Project to America's Warrior Partnership. That's a little bit about me.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff. And one thing that is really very interesting is what you mentioned about identifying the special operations members that needed help, and as they were getting out. Even in a smaller community, that's a difficult thing to do, identifying the people, because I've seen it before. I've seen it with just, you know, the regular veterans that I served with that maybe weren't spec ops, all that kind of stuff. They were just vehicle mechanics or refuelers or whatever they were doing. You know, you lose them. They go out into the ether. Yeah. They go out into America, and it's very hard to bring them back in. I find that I probably was one of those guys as well. When I left the military was gone for many years. I didn't have a lot of veteran friends. I had some guys and girls that were still in the service. Came back to an area where veterans don't, you know, you're not walking into the VFW or the American Legion. There's not a big presence. So
yeah.
I went into the ether, and it's unfortunate because I missed out on a lot of opportunity because I wasn't in touch with organizations. And I think that's pretty interesting. Now, America's Warriors Partnership has to deal with that. Even now outside of the Spec Ops Command, how do you undertake that and identify these people that are in need?
So we do it. Our philosophy is that you just do it community by community, county by county, municipality by municipality. We have a book, we wrote a concept called community integration. And the idea around community integration is that it's a four-step plan. It's connect is the first step. And it's connect with the veterans in the community, all veterans, no matter whether they're seeking help or not. Connect with organizations in the community that serve or that want to support. So it's connect at that level. Educate the veteran about opportunities that they may not even be aware of.
Yep.
And that's having a conversation. So once you have a connection, you build a relationship, you figure out where the veteran wants to go and what they want to do. By the way, 85 to 90% of the veterans that we're connected with are looking for purpose. They're looking for volunteer opportunities. They're not looking for a handout. They're looking for an opportunity to give a hand to somebody else. So connect, educate the community about the value of veterans and why it's not just the right thing to do, but business-wise, it's the smart thing to do. When we work in a community, we quantify the economic impact it's had on a community. And on average, just serving veterans can have a $60 million impact on a medium-sized community because the veteran's getting their health care from the VA. The veteran's getting their GI Bill benefit. They're getting their disability payment. They're getting so many federal resources brought into the community that we want to educate the communities that not only is it the right thing to do and it's a smart thing to do, but economically it's really smart to do.
Yeah.
So that comes in the education. Advocate for the veteran when they hit a roadblock, not to be enabling but be empowering in that advocacy. Then the other piece is, I never met a community that didn't say, I want to be the best community, the number one community for veterans in the nation when they set out to do it. So somebody needs to advocate for them. And then the last thing is collaborate. You got to collaborate with everyone. As long as they have the best interest of the veteran and their family in mind. And you can figure out working at the local level, who are focused on their organization and who are focused on the work. And that's really, I say it's cutting the wheat from the chaff. It's figuring out who's in it for the right reasons and then working together to make things happen. And, I'll just tell you that when we work in the community, we find that 90% of veterans issues can be solved locally. You just have to know, where the resources are and you have to know what the veterans need. The other 10% are the tough ones, and America's Warrior Partnership has a program for those communities that are short. But anyways, that's the idea of what we do. I love what you started out by saying. We talk about communities. the only way we're going to solve this problem, especially around veteran suicide, is through communities. It's not a beltway solution. It's a community solution.
Yeah. We definitely are in complete agreement with you because, you know your neighbor. You know your friend's father or mother. You know your cousin or your brother or sister. You know when they're off. You know when something, they're, I haven't seen a guy mow his lawn in 3 weeks. And normally that lawn is perfect. Yeah. That's a huge red flag. I know that this guy picks his kid up from school every single day. He never misses it. And I haven't seen him for a week and a half. Huge red flag. We can monitor each other, and I'm not saying this in a creepy neighbor way. I'm saying it in a positive way where we're taking care of the person next to you and you're lifting them up. You also know what each person needs. You know their strengths. You're willing to walk into a job with them and say, hey, I recommend this guy or girl, because they're my neighbor and I know they're a hard worker and hey, maybe they just fell on some tough times, but I know that they're the best person for this job and you should take my word for it. That's a huge thing. And that only comes with community.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And again, it's you have to know who the vets are, number one, and then you have to know who your community is. And when you bring those two together, it doesn't matter whether you're New York City or whether you're rural Iowa. It's the same thing. It works. I think you've captured it right. And for us at America's Warrior Partnership, our focus has always been to improve the quality of life for veterans. Mm-hmm. And measuring quality of life is tough, right? It's very subjective. And so what we did was we looked and saw that quality of life really was aligned with suicide, suicidal ideations, low quality of life, low hope, higher suicidal ideations. And with our study that we were doing, we learned that we could quantify the number of deaths accurately. And so what we've done is, again, when we say to prevent veteran suicide, it's to measure the number of suicides that have gone down in your community. And I think that if you can lower the suicide rate and demonstrate it, what you're going to see naturally is that the quality of life is going to go up, and that veterans are going to see that there's a lot of hope and that their neighbors are lifting them up.
Yeah. And like you said, I don't think there's any community that doesn't want to be the number one community for veterans. I mean, it's very easy. It's very easy to say. It's a very easy thing to want. And from a selfish standpoint, the community, like you said, benefits from it. When you talk about the middle class, when you talk about, the creation of the middle class after World War II, it was the GI Bill and the VA home loan that did it. I mean, there's really no arguing about that. That's a pretty basic fact. And the reason is it brings money into the community, whether it's buying real estate, whether it's, renting in the area, whether it's working in the area. You're going to school, so now the community has, a higher graduation from a college level rate. All these things play in. And like you said, you can see it because gradually quality of life, standard of living goes up. So all of these things are benefits.
Yeah, all the things that you're saying, I got to just tell you that there was a great study done by Citi here a few years ago that found that veterans volunteered at a 90% higher rate than non-veterans. When we do our annual survey, and we've done it for the last 8 years, it's available on our website. But when we've done our annual survey, the number one thing that veterans are seeking from their community are physical and recreational activities. Number two, connections to other veterans. And number three, volunteer opportunities. Mm-hmm. You can't, that's indisputable that if you can provide that at your community level and you can mobilize the veterans to serve back into their community, your community is going to be a better place in the end.
And it's something that's almost kind of like you do it without even thinking about it. Like when I started the podcast, I would ask for people to come out to races or if we were doing a rebuild at a VFW or something like that. And people would just come, and I'm like, really? Like, this, you just wanted to do this? Like, I was very surprised on a Saturday when football's on. I'm like, I just asked you to. I didn't know anybody was going to show up, but it's so easy. And then I started thinking about
more sandwiches.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I didn't even bring enough drills. Then I start thinking back in my life, and my father, who's an Army veteran, always volunteered. always volunteered. Yeah. And I didn't ever thought of him as this big volunteer guy, like, but he always did. He always did. He was always a member of some board or something going on with the school or one of the sports clubs or the beach or whatever. You know, it didn't really make a difference, but he was always doing something. And then I found I was always doing the same thing. So it's kind of, it's almost like you're doing it without thinking about it. You know, veterans want to serve. And when they lose that ability to serve, that's when we start going to a really dark place. When we start losing, we lose that mission and we lose the ability to give back to the community. That's when we go somewhere where we don't want to be.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I think that, you know, the nation, you know, some people would say it's divided. Some people would, you know, criticize where we are, but I think as a nation, if we embrace the veterans and let's not forget their families.
Yeah.
You know, these families are volunteering, you know, enormously. I remember, you know, I stayed back one time and, you know, to mobilize the military, the families that were left behind, they were easy. You just said, hey, we need, so-and-so needs help. And before you knew it, everybody was swarming around to help them. And I think that's just innate in the fact that you serve, you know, that, the fact that you raise your hand to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, is pretty much a, you know, it's a statement of volunteerism. I think we can do a lot better.
Yeah.
You know,
and the families always do. They want to help out. I remember when I was stationed in Italy, we did Project Yellow Ribbon in the hangars for everybody that was deploying. We had the army going through all the time, going down to, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. And especially at the beginning of the Iraq War, never did we not have enough volunteers to give things out, help out with, you know, family needs, whatever the case may be, because every spouse and every kid that was at the local high school or something like that was out there volunteering in that hangar every single time we had a deployment.
Yeah. You know, and you brought up something before, and that's that, that when you volunteer and you're around others and you get to know who your neighbors are, you get to know when they're on and you get to know when they're off.
Yep.
And I think, you know, we talk about getting upstream from the suicide. And the first thing about getting upstream is recognizing that there's a need, that there's something that's just not right. And then having a close enough relationship that you can say, hey, you doing okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you just can't say that to anybody. You have to have a relationship where you can say a trust, where you can say, are you doing okay? And then when the answer is no, I'm not, know how, what the next step is. All right, well, let's figure out how to get you to the support you need. And I think, you know, you were dead on in terms of that relationship is, and that knowledge, recognition that something's just not right is key.
Yeah. It for sure. And again, that only happens when you are a member of a community and there's people around you that you trust that actually works. Because if not, it breaks down almost instantly. It's so quick how things can happen and how we could go down a dark path. And I think what you were saying about finding those upstream, red flags is really important, because after the fact, we're already too late. You know, that you're not saving that person then. But if you can save them 2 months prior because you saw things happening, that's huge.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think, you know, there's a lot of focus on the how did somebody take their life, right? A lot of discussion about the how. And I think it's important. However, we need to figure out the why, right? And the why is getting upstream. And, it's a public health approach. I think the CDC is doing a great job in terms of their research, and they can do more. They're a great partner of ours. But, you know, you're in New York. I'll use you as your state as an example. You have county veteran service officers throughout your state.
Yep.
Someone said, well, how many should we have? And I said, what I would do is I would look at the number of recruiters that you have in your community, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard. And I would say, I'm going to match the number, you know, the federal government, I'm going to match the number of recruiters that you have from the services that are recruiting them out of your community to recruit them back into your community and to take care of them and to get to know who they are.
I mean, that's simple math right there.
isn't it easy? You go, okay, there's a recruitment office there. They got five staff. We need a reverse transition office over here with five staff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's nothing worse. There's nothing worse than when you're trying to get in touch with, you know, your VSO, whether it's a county VSO or however your state runs it.
Yeah.
And you get an answering machine or an individual on the other end that has so many phone calls that there's no way they're getting back to you. It's not going to happen. 2-3 weeks are going to go by. You're still not going to get a phone call. And it's not that person's fault. They're set up to fail in that regard.
I agree. And I think there needs to be more emphasis. So, you know, one of the things that we advocate for is that that it should be community based. And the VA, they're great. You know, I'm a VA. I get my services from the VA and et cetera. But I mean, they're not everywhere.
No.
And the point is that, you know, if the federal government invested as much in our demobilization as they did in our recruitment, we'd probably be in a pretty good place.
Yeah. We wouldn't be doing all these podcasts about the same topic all the time and trying to fix it at the community level. And I mean, we would have those things, but they would be ancillary. We would just be able to have that as a, hey, we want to help you out. Not as, hey, this isn't being fixed. We have to fix it ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
So getting to the fixing part and talking about those upstream, you know, red flags and that information that we could use ahead of time to help prevent veteran suicide, I want to talk a little bit about Operation Deep Dive and the research that your organization does, because I think research is very important. It kind of guides us, lets us know where we need to go, where we need to improve, and how we could do our job better overall. Again, even at the community level, like, okay, what services are needed? What VSOs need, assistance? What ones are doing, you know, more than we ever could have asked them to do? So talk to me a little bit about Operation Deep Dive and what that's about.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we have community-based programs throughout the United States. And about 5 years ago, suicide prevention was really becoming a thing that we were— it hadn't changed in 30 years. Mm-hmm. The number had pretty much stayed the same and gone up a little bit. And we stepped back and said, how can we do suicide prevention at the community level? And how can we create a strategy that was specific to that community? And remember, you know, one of the communities we had was Buffalo, New York, and another community we had was Orange County, California.
Okay.
And what we knew is that the demographics of the veteran, the community resources, the environment in Orange County was very different than Buffalo, New York. And we said, it can't be the same strategy for both of these because it's very different. So we dug in to do some literature reviews and found that nobody had really done a community-based suicide study around veterans. And so we said, hey, let's do it. I called a friend of mine at the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation just to see if she knew of any studies that were out there. And I told her what we were thinking about doing. And she said, can you write me a proposal? And, you know, for the first phase of the Operation Deep Dive was funded by the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation. We're going into our second phase and we're looking for funding. But in that first phase, we really did something that was pretty revolutionary. And what we did was we went out to the states and asked them if they would provide us with all of their death data, like everyone who died from 2014 to 2018. And the states gave it to us. There was 8 states that provided it. New York wasn't one of them, but there was a Massachusetts and Maine in New England provided as an example. So anyways, what we did was when we received all the death data from the states, we sent it to the Department of Defense, just the names and socials of those who died. And DOD came back and they said, here's their military service experience. So we were able to merge service experience to death. And what we found was that, it confirmed what we suspected. The veteran, as an example, in the panhandle of Florida who takes their life is very different than the veteran in Miami, is very different than that veteran in Montana. And is very different than the veteran in Massachusetts, in Eastern Massachusetts, and different from the veteran in Western Massachusetts. And so we said, okay, we've got this data. What are some of the more specific things we can do to apply it? And so Operation Deep Dive, one of the things, the big one of the big findings we had was that when a veteran dies in a community in these states, 25% of the time, they're not counted correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, I've heard this before.
What that means is that 17% of the veterans who died in these states on average were never recognized as having served. And for me, you know, statistically, that was troubling. Mm-hmm. Morally, that really bothered me, because then I thought these people weren't buried with military honors and they earned it. And we don't have a system or a way for anybody to validate and confirm that they actually served in the military so that we can honor them. So that bothered me. Then the other piece was, so that was 18%. Then 7% of the time, we counted people who never served in the military, which is okay, because most of the time, medical examiners and coroners and funeral home directors are it's just they're asking friends, families, and coworkers, did they serve?
Of course.
And the answer might be yes or no, or they may not know. The other thing I just want to point out about the undercount is that it was heavily weighted towards female veterans. So if a female died, it was less likely that the coroner, medical examiner, or funeral home director would ask, did they serve in the military?
Right.
Just because of the bias, there, mm-hmm. right? So that was the big thing that we found, was that first there was an undercount. The second thing that we found when we received all the data, National Guard, Reserve, active duty, all the time, one of the things that we found was that the National Guard was overrepresented in these deaths, and we weren't really counting them as the VA doesn't count National Guard deaths. Nor do they count active duty deaths unless they meet the federal criteria, or reserve deaths unless they meet federal criteria. And what we found was it was about 12% of the deaths were counted that way. So anyways, what we found was that on suicide, we were 37% higher than what the VA had reported for the same states.
Wow.
And we attribute it to the undercounting, and we attribute it to the fact that we did count Guard and Reserve who had active duty federal time, but may have been missed in a previous counts. So numbers, that's where we are with the numbers. But really, the impact was, what we found was, every year you served in the military reduced your risk by 2%, right? So if you had somebody who started out and served 20 years, their risk was lowered by 40%.
Hmm.
That means the highest risk, obviously, were the younger, were those who had short terms. We found that somebody who had who had less than 3 years was at much higher risk than somebody who had 4 years of service, like almost dramatically higher. We found that time since discharge, you know, everybody talks about the 1 year since discharge is the big. We found that that's really the third year and the 20th year were big spikes, and we're not sure why. We need to dive into that in the next phase. The one other thing that we found, and it probably won't surprise you, is that anybody who received a demotion anytime in their career increased their odds of taking their own life by 56%. And it stayed with them.
Wow.
They could have done 4 years, they could have done 20 years, but it didn't matter because they were at high risk for the rest of their life.
I'm not surprised, that's a high number. I'm surprised at the number, not the fact.
Yeah, the number is like, you know, yeah. So the other piece of it is those who live alone increase their odds by 40%. So if you, and then lastly, you know, everybody laughs at the Coast Guard, but when we compared the Coast Guard, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, the service at greatest risk was the Coast Guard.
I've heard that before, and it's always surprising to me.
We scratched our heads, and then we talked to the states, and the state director said, no, it doesn't surprise us at all. You should see what the Coast Guard go through. They carry a lot of burden.
Yep.
There's a lot of things that they have. And so when, you know, if you were to look at it nationally, you'd say the person at greatest risk nationally for us would be a Coast Guardsman who served less than 3 years, who lives alone and had a demotion. And if that's the case, that's the person you want to go find. And if you can find them and build a relationship with them and get upstream, even if they're fine, but let them know that if they had something, they should turn to you, they can. Well, so that's on the national. When we look at the panhandle of Florida, the veteran who's there looks different than others. And so for us, it was, I've got limited amount of resources. I've got to go out and find the veterans and build a relationship with them. So who do I go look for? And then and this was sort of a roadmap on who to look for first. And then once you took care of that, then look at the second target, and then the third target, and the fourth target.
See, that's this is why I get very into studies like this. Because, one, there's a lot of surprising data that comes out of it. Yeah. But the other thing that I always see from studies like this, or again, this was a one-of-a-kind type study. This was the first one that was done like this. But in other areas, we're taught in the military to solve problems at the lowest level, right? Yep. When you first get in the military, you don't go run into your drill instructor when there's an issue. You solve it.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to your drill
instructor.
Do a lot
of push-ups.
Right. When you get out in the field, you don't go to your LT or your captain. You know, you go to your platoon sergeant, you go to your, you know, the E4 mafia, whatever it is you want to talk to. Okay. But we're told to solve it at the lowest level. Studies like this, I feel that's what they're doing, because you're giving the data to the lowest level and saying, hey, this, we know there's a problem in this community. Let's go out and help them. Let's get to them before there's a problem. Not wait until they are in, already attempted a suicide, or they're in a drug addiction program, or whatever the case may be. We're getting to you because you're at a higher risk. We're going to go reach out and just start a relationship. And then this way, we know if you're doing well or not. We know if you're falling into a bad pattern, and we can get out ahead of it. And I think, like you said, with the community level work, with the VSOs and all of that, you're solving the problem at the lowest level. You're not saying to the federal government, hey, fix veteran suicide.
But we need them.
You need them. No, you do.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. Because they have the data. that's first off, is they have a lot of the data, which we're going to use at the lower level.
Yeah. That's what we're hoping to partner with them, with the VA, is to share the data. But in terms of service, you know, they're the most prolific veteran service program in the nation, which is the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Yep.
And it's a matter of, hey, are you enrolled? Like one of our measures is when we meet a vet, it's like, are you enrolled in the VA? And if they go, oh no, it's too hard, or I'm not eligible, we go, no. Let's go through this. It's not too hard. We'll take you over there right now and get you enrolled. You may not need it today, but when you do need it, it's going to take you too long to get enrolled.
Yeah.
So do it today.
Yeah.
And, you know, do it before the crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Again, getting out ahead, that upstream thought process. I keep saying it again and again, and it's right off your website. That upstream is so important, because, again, if you're already past it, getting somebody out of the depths is the hardest thing in the world to do.
I always said, and I tell people, I said, you know, I know you've met someone who you said, I wish I knew you 6 months ago, because you wouldn't be in the position you're in now. Well, how do we get 6 months up and not let them get into a point? I used to say in the military, it's really tough to change no, right?
Yep.
It's really tough to change. Once you're arrested, it's really tough to get you out of jail. So let's keep you from getting arrested. How about that?
Yeah. You see it with the federal hiring right now. There's a huge push to hire veterans. Almost every federal organization, with the infrastructure bill and everything like that, is hiring direct veteran. They don't even have to go through USA jobs. You can walk a resume to the supervisor, and they can hire off the street if you're a veteran. That helps the guy that wants a job. But if you've already been unemployed for 2 years, man, I wish I would have been able to help you 2 years ago, so that you weren't unemployed for 2 years. You had all that hardship. Now you have the mounting bills. You may or may not be able to wait a little longer for the federal job, because it does take a little time to get in and all of that. Man, if I could have got to you earlier, I really could have saved you a lot of trouble.
And I think this is where the county VSOs come in. And I think this is where local organizations come in, is that they know who to look for. But I mean, the Department of Labor has a new program called ENPP. It's the acronym, and it's a public partnership. And so what they do is when somebody's going through TAPS, they'll say, okay, where are you headed to? And there's a list of community based programs, and they'll say, oh, you're going to the Panhandle of Florida. Well, here's a community group that you can connect with ahead of it, so that we can help move it. we want to, I hope that they expand it, but I mean, there's a lot of innovative things that are coming out. It's, you know, but one of the things that I do would say to you is I've been doing this work since 2005 and it just frustrates the heck out of me that we're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And you know, there's going to be another war because it always happens in the United States. We're going to be at a major event again in the next 10 to 20 years, but we shouldn't have to refigure things out. And we should figure it out now so that we're ready the next time.
Yeah. It's always better to be proactive than reactive.
I mean,
that's how you win wars. You're proactive. You don't. And if we're taking this and we're using that mantra, and this is a war that we're fighting now here in the States, mm-hmm. be proactive and win the war. Don't wait to see what happens. And then, oh, okay, now I should do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, we've learned a lot over the last, what is it? Almost 21 years.
Yeah.
We should figure it out.
Yeah.
And then have it in place for the next time.
For sure.
Because there is going to be a next time.
There always will be. Yes. There. As long as the United States is around, there's going to be a next time. You know, it's unfortunate. Yeah. It's part of being on the world stage, but it's going to happen. Tell us where we can get more information about America's Warrior Partnership, websites, all that kind of stuff, so that people can go check it out. And, you know, if they know VSOs that need to get connected, or if they want to volunteer and get involved and all of that, where can they go?
So go to www.americaswarriorpartnership.org. On that site, you'll see the communities that we work in, and you can ask for help. If you live in those communities, reach out to those people.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't live in those communities and you need help, we have a program called America's Warrior Partnership Network. And what the network does is we work with about 1,000 communities throughout the United States. And we have partnered up with 70 national service providers. And the network serves as a broker between those communities and national programs. If you're a veteran and needs help, we will find somebody in your community who can help you. All you have to do is go to www.americaswarriorpartnership.org and go to the network, and there will be somebody there who can help you out.
Excellent. That's great information, and there's no reason to not get help. I mean, whether you're an organization looking to do more or you're a veteran that needs help, please get over to the website, check it out. This might be exactly what you're looking for. And again, to get out before there's a real problem or before we get to a point where we can't help somebody. We want to get out on those upstream red flags and issues.
Yeah.
Jim, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It's been a blast talking to you again, another Air Force veteran doing some great stuff.
Yeah,
I always love having Air Force veterans on because I get to talk to them for a little bit. Again, thank you so much. It's been a blast talking to you.
Great. Thanks, Jason. I appreciate it.
All righty, sir. You have a great rest of the day. Thank you.
All right. You too. Take care.